Okay, so we're resuming our study tonight in the book of 1 Peter. We're in chapter 3. And so we're studying now in this section, verses 1 through 6, that is continuing the subject from back in chapter 2 that is centered on different authority arrangements which Christians have to submit to because all authority in heaven and in earth is possessed by Jesus Christ, given to him by his Father when he raised him from the dead, because of his fulfillment of all of his Father's will and that obedience unto death, even that death on the cross. So he's been given all authority in heaven and in earth and is at his Father's right hand. So all authority arrangements that we have on this earth are under Christ's authority. And so therefore, as we have seen with all of these and the applications he gives, as Christians, we have to be in subjection to those authorities that we're under and be obedient. And he uses that word subjection for every one of these, starting in chapter 2 with the ordinances of man and those earthly rulers that we have from the king on down, from the top down, all that the Lord has put over us. So as far as a governmental authority, we have to submit to that. We have to obey every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake. He told us that in chapter 2, verse 13. And then we had the application of verse 18 of chapter 2 with our earthly masters, in this case, of course, when it was an actual slave-master relationship. But we have the application for us with we have jobs with bosses. So when we are under the authority of another in our work arrangements, do we have to follow the rules at work? We do. And what if the boss is mean and unfair? That's the point. It's not just to the good and gentle, but also to the froward, he said in verse 18 of chapter 2. And so this is teaching us, with as in keeping with the main subject of the book of 1 Peter. I use that term. What other subject is addressed with every single chapter and with the volume that he deals with suffering for righteousness' sake here in this book? Is there any other subject that is dealt with as extensively from beginning to end of 1 Peter than that subject of our suffering for righteousness' sake and enduring those sufferings and all the manifold temptations that come with them? I mean, that is the main subject that we see throughout. And so this is part of that. So are we going to ever suffer because we're Christians at the hands of those who might possess authority over us in some way? Yes, that is a common way in which the devil will bring persecution upon us through someone who has authority over us. Has a government ever persecuted Christians? I mean, yes, was that involved in Christ's crucifixion? It was very much involved in that. This very day and time that we live in, are there any places on earth today where government officials are involved in the persecution of Christians? Yes, and we've known about that. We've got some that have, of course, the Johnsons just returned from India, and we have some that grew up there. We have Jan and Farrah getting ready to leave to go there, Lord willing, tomorrow. But over in that land, just being one that many of us are very familiar with, That happens right now, presently, in parts of that country, and other countries in the world. So that has been around from the beginning of the church, and that's a reason why he tells us in 1 Timothy chapter 2 to pray for those authorities, so that we can live quiet and peaceable lives in all godliness and honesty. But if it happens to be that we are in a situation where the government is persecuting us as Christians, does that free us from any obligation to have to obey the rules, the laws of the land? Or do we still have to obey those laws? We still have to submit ourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, with what lone exception that applies in all of these? If there's ever a command given that contradicts or would require us to disobey the Lord, in which case that would not be a reflection of the Lord's authority, that would be against it. So in that case, do we obey God or men? Always God. But outside of that situation, all we have to obey the laws of the land. We have to submit to the earthly authorities, even if we're being persecuted. Well, what about the authority relationship that we might have in our earthly vocation? If we've got a bad, mean boss that knows we're a Christian and has given us a hard time, and because of that, and making our life miserable at work because we're a follower of Christ, do we not have to obey the rules at work anymore? Or do we have to endure that? We have to endure that. And likewise, he says at the beginning of chapter 3, wives must be in subjection to their own husbands. And he's there particularly with that word likewise. Is he talking about a Christian woman that has a godly and loving Christian husband that treats or honors her and treats her well? Or is he talking, well, she would have to be in subjection to that, to him, and that should be the easiest one to be in subjection to, that is loving her as Christ loved the church. Is it really hard for us to submit to Christ as his church? If that's problematic for us, then obviously there's some deep problem that we have within our own hearts. But how could you have a better master than Christ? Husbands, that's what we're aspiring to. That's the example that we're to follow and to be like as head of our homes, and particularly in our relationship with our wives, which that's going to be coming up in verse 7 here, Lord willing. Well, it's in verse 7, but we'll get to it in our study of the Lord willing. But is that the main focus of verses 1 through 6 here in 1 Peter 3, where a Christian wife has a Christian husband that treats her well and that she's being told to be in subjection to him? She would have to be, and there's other scriptures that say that, but what's the situation that he's dealing with here in keeping with the main subject of this book? Is this a Christian woman in this case that he's talking about that has a believing husband that's treating her well, or does she have an unbelieving husband that's mistreating her? Well, he's saying likewise, in the same way that servant in chapter 2, verse 18, is to be subject not just to the good and gentle master, but also the froward. And so here he says plainly in verse 1, this husband is... has not obeyed the word of God. And the goal is that he would be won by his wife, not by her words, but beating him over the head with teaching him the scriptures. Her role there is, without the word, to win him by her behavior. And so that's, if he were a child of God, then how does he need to be won to Christ if he was already the Lord's? So he's looking at this situation where you have a Christian woman that has a non-Christian husband. And just to remind ourselves for the umpteenth time on that, what is the one and only way that that should ever happen? It's not by a Christian woman going to the altar and marrying a man that is not a child of God. Would that be a good thing, a wise and right thing to do for a Christian to marry an unbeliever? Or would this be a situation where they both, the husband and the wife, they're married, they're not Christians, but now she's converted? He's not. So now you have a situation where you have a member of the Lord's body that's married to someone who's not. In this case, it's the wife, which, what percentage of cases where you have a married couple that are not Christians, the one that's going to be converted first is going to be the wife? I don't know the exact answer to that, but it's not 50% or just a little above 50%. The vast majority of the cases where this happens, I mean, that's a fact, isn't it? Most of the time, it's the wife that's converted first. Not always, but the vast majority of the cases it is. And even if they both end up being converted, it's usually the woman first. And this happens. I mean, and we probably all have known situations like this. And if not a case where some here may have even been in that situation, but what is she to do with a husband like that? And especially here, in keeping with this context, if he resents the fact that she's now been converted to Christ and he is not happy with the changes that she's made, is it going to affect their relationship? Are there things that maybe they did together when neither one of them were followers of Christ that now she's not going to do because she's a Christian? She's going to have an entirely different goal in life. She's going to have a different purpose in life. And where they were both of the world before, she's coming out from the world. Well, he's still in the world. Is it going to be the same or different? It's going to be very different for him. Can he respond? Is it out of the realm of possibility he could respond in a very negative way and really give her a lot of difficulty and persecute her because of what that decision that she's made to follow Christ? Well, that's really what he's talking about here. And what is the obligation of a Christian woman in that situation? Is she released from the obligation to have to be in subjection to her husband? No, because this is an authority arrangement that was made where? Well, that's the when, but the where is heaven. I mean, it's from God. This is a divine authority arrangement, not of man, it's of God. But yes, it does go back to the very beginning when God established the family. And he's the one that established the headship in the family for the husband and father. So this is as with all these authority arrangements, is from above. It's not of man. Does that therefore change ever for a Christian? If God has established an authority, when does it go away? Yeah. When children, they're under their parents' authority, yes, when they grow up and then they start their own families and leave home and leave father and mother to cleave to their wife and the wife to the husband, well, then they're no longer directly under the parents' authority. But, I mean, other than that, really, well, of course, we could, if we have a bad boss, we might have an opportunity to change jobs. But the fact is, we're going to have earthly authorities. The government authority is going to be there. The family structure and the authority arrangement in the home, that remains. And whatever it is that we're under as a Christian, we have to be obedient to those authorities, even with the one, even when the ones that are wielding that authority are mistreating us for that. We have to follow the steps of Christ and suffer wrongfully as he taught us, and that's why he went into all those verses that we saw from verses 19 to 25 chapter 2. But with the where we have seen so far in chapter 3, we noted that it's the behavior of the wife, in this case of the Christian wife, that can win their husbands. And we saw from verse 2 that chaste behavior coupled with fear, and that's the word for purity, and that fear, of course, is the fear of the Lord, that that love of righteousness and hatred of evil. And so if she's if she has purity and a hunger and thirst for righteousness and turning away from evil, and then her adorning is of the inner man, which, as we saw when we looked at that word cosmos, which is the word for orderly arrangement, usually referring to the arrangement that God has made of the heavenly bodies that he created. Well, here he's talking about what the orderly arrangement is for the Christian woman, and focus to be on the outside, or what's in the inside, the outer man or the inner man? Well, that's what he said in verse 3, not of the outward, verse 4, but of the hidden man of the heart. Why? Because that's what's incorruptible. If a Christian wife is trying to win her non-Christian husband by her physical attractiveness, is that the way the Lord's going to use to win her heart, win his heart to him? Or is he going to use what's in her heart and the goodness and the qualities of Christ and the parts of his love that would be formed there and come out in her behavior? Because it's what's in her heart that's going to be manifest by her behavior that she's exhibiting. And that adorning there is to be of that meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. And that's where we were finishing up in our study last week. And we were noting there meekness being a quality of Christ, being part of his nature, that's part of the divine nature, which is why when he's teaching this and emphasizing what this Christian wife is to have in her heart, Christian men need to have this too. I mean, Christ was meek and humble in heart, so which of his followers should be? All of them, all of us. So that's for all of us. I mean, I believe last week I asked the question, what part of the nature of Christ is a Christian woman supposed to have that a Christian man is not, or vice versa? I mean, there's not a different kind of heart that each of us to have. We all have that same goal, to have the same heart of Christ, male and female. In this case, he's showing that that's what the adorning needs to be for the Christian wife in the treatment of her husband, and the power that's in that. He could be won by that behavior when he sees her example. I mean, he would have to have a very hard heart if he's mistreating her, and then all he's getting in return is her being in subjection and showing him kindness and meekness and humility, and if he was to persist in that mistreatment of her and she keeps showing him that heart of Christ by her behavior in return? I mean, is he going to soften up eventually? Well, he'd have to be pretty hard-hearted not to, and he could soften to the point of being won to Christ by her behavior. That would be a great shame to him if he continued to mistreat her. But the fact is this is what a Christian woman is told to do. And even if he doesn't do what he should do, she still has to do that. That's the obligation there. Just like when would back in chapter 2, verse 18, if a slave has a froward master, one who is persecuting him, how does a slave get out of that situation? Well, if we vowed before God, man, till death do us part, and there's no adultery committed by the man here, then how does this woman have a way out of the marriage? A way that would be not by man's permission, but by God's? No. So what's she to do? Same thing that master in chapter 2, verse 18 is, follow in the steps of Christ and suffer wrongfully. Does he say that will be easy, or does he say that's the example that Christ has set for us to walk in? But he does show that hope and that possibility that he could be won to Christ by that behavior. But if she responds to his mistreatment of her, not with the heart of Christ, but if she's failing the temptation, and it would be strong, but if she's failing the temptation she's speaking back to him in a way, or not subjecting herself to him and treating him in a way where she's returning evil for evil, is that going to win him to Christ? That won't. So it's a big test, but these are going back to the beginning of this book and chapter 1. I mean, these are the trials on one's faith that can happen, and the manifold temptations that can come through them. But is she going to be purified as gold by the Lord by going through this situation and following in the steps of Christ through all of this? And continuing to endure that grief and suffering wrongfully for his sake, what's the Lord going to do with her and informing her into the image of Christ through all that? And what kind of reward will she have in eternity for that? So what does he say in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 17 about our affliction versus the glory that will follow? For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far exceeding and eternal weight of glory. So the affliction, and one might think, well, this marriage it lasts forever. Well, it goes by fast. This one will probably go by slower, or at least it would seem like it, perhaps. But still, how long are we here? Whatever trial we have, that affliction, how long does it last compared to eternity? He says, but for a moment. I mean, what is this life compared to eternity? And the degree of the affliction, what is it compared to the reward that will come? The reward will be far exceeding in its weight compared to the affliction that is comparatively light. And it will be for eternity instead of this comparative moment that the affliction is. So he reminds us of that. Whatever he's calling us to go through in these trials, it is temporary, but he will reward us richly for eternity for submitting to his will in this way. So she's going to have a great reward from the Lord for this. And it may also include her husband being converted to Christ. And how great will her reward be if she behaves herself in such a way that he actually seeks the Lord because of seeing her example of the Lord and his heart through her? That is going to be quite a reward she would receive. Now he gives in verses 5 and 6 the example of the women of old time, as he puts it, because he says, after this manner, so let's read verses 5 and 6, for after this manner in the old time, the holy women also who trusted in God adorned themselves, being in subjection unto their own husbands. Even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters ye are, as long as you do well and are not afraid with any amazement. So when he says the Christian woman has to be in subjection to her husband, well, again, as Brother Jan pointed out, is this a new thing? Or does this go back to the beginning when God established the family? And how many examples do we have of holy women of God who followed God's arrangement in the home? And so this is not something new for women that are in Christ to be in subjection to their own husbands after this manner in the old time. The holy women also who trusted in God. Now there are some qualifiers there for a woman to willingly be in subjection to her husband. That's a command of God. How many women that are not followers of God are going to do that? There's not going to be many, if any, are there? But this is a characteristic of holy women, those holy that are set apart for God. If a woman understands the teachings of God's word and knows what the commandment of God is, and if she has separated herself to follow the Lord, then is she going to follow that commandment he gives her? Well, she'll do that, and that's what the holy women of old time did. And it says, who trusted in God. Now, for a woman to be in subjection to her husband in this life, is that going to come, well, number one, as we've just seen, is that going to come without holiness, being set apart for God? No. Is it going to come without trust in the Lord? How much would you have to trust? How much do we... And we've seen this before. How much do we have to trust the Lord to submit to an authority that's over us, especially when that authority is being misused against us because we are following Christ? Well, that was the thing he pointed out about Christ and what he did back in chapter 2, verse 23. When he was reviled, he reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. So how, when Jesus had done no wrong, and then he was being sent to the cross, what made him willing to do that, where he was going to be crucified? What had the Father promised his Son that would happen when he obeyed his Father to that point of death? What had he promised the Son? Which would mean what was going to have to happen after his death. 3 days later. Did the Father promise to raise the Son from the dead? I mean, Jesus foretold. Did Jesus know what was going to happen to him? Did he know what cup he was going to have to drink? Did he know all the scriptures that were spoken about him? And he spoke about those things to his disciples. Now, at the time before his resurrection, was it the Father's will for them to understand those things, or was it hidden from them at that time? It was hidden from them, but he spoke them. Now, after his resurrection, then it was the Father's will for them to understand those things, and he opened their minds to understand those scriptures. That's in Luke 24, where he says that in verse 45 plainly. But prior to that, they didn't understand what he was saying, but he still foretold those things. But did Jesus know? Did he not tell them what was going to happen to him, and he was going to be delivered into the hands of those wicked men, and that they were going to crucify him? And did he also not say, but he would be raised again on the third day? Did he not give, when he was asked for a sign, did he give them the sign of the prophet Jonah? And what did he say about at the very beginning of his ministry when he started doing the miracles there in Jerusalem? What did he say? What did he foretell about the temple? He said, "You destroy this temple, I'll build it again and rebuild it in 3 days." What was he talking about? Yes, and it says that his disciples understood afterwards. They remembered those words. So how many times did Jesus foretell his resurrection as well as foretelling his death? And the prophets foretold of all of that. He understood it fully. So he knew his Father's promise that he would raise him from the dead. But for him to willingly go to the cross, how much did he have to trust his Father that he would fulfill that promise and raise him from the dead? If he didn't fully believe that and did not fully trust his Father, if there was any doubt about whether he'd be raised from the dead again, then why would he have been willing to drink that cup? It says that he committed himself to him that judges righteously. How much did he trust the Father that he was going to fulfill his will and that he would raise him from the dead when he obeyed his Father to that point of his dying on the cross? 100%. And whose steps are we to walk in? I mean, he says that there in chapter 2, right when he's told us that he's left us those steps to follow, which I know at that time we looked at the end of chapter 4, the last verse of it. What does he say there for us? Chapter 4, verse 19, "Wherefore let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well-doing as unto a faithful Creator." For us to walk in the steps of Christ, to follow those steps through enduring all of these sufferings, these trials on our faith, and continue to do what is good and right in His sight, to subject ourselves to authorities that are persecuting us, do we have to trust the Lord?
We have to have the same heart as Christ.
Yes. Fully.
We too know what our Heavenly Father can do.
We've been given that same promise.
As long as I obey Him, He's going to do exactly what He has said He will do.
Christ was promised that, and we're promised that. Christ fully trusted the Father that He would fulfill that. Otherwise, could He have gotten through all of those sufferings? I mean, He makes a direct connection between His enduring those persecutions, not reviling back, not returning evil for evil, but he didn't fall to any of the temptations. What got him through it, one of the main things that he points out there, was his committing his soul to his Father who judges righteously, that trust in his Father that he tells us that how are we going to get through all of these trials on our faith if we don't have the same trust in the Father that Christ did? Those are the steps to walk in. The suffering, but it's also what got him through the sufferings. What he understood, what he believed, we have to understand and believe. And we have to have that same trust in the Lord. Those holy women of old that were in subjection to their own husbands and adorned themselves, not with the outer but the inner man, I mean, did they trust the Lord to do that? I mean, that's key here. So after this manner in old time, the holy women also who trusted in God adorned themselves. Now, when we read in the scriptures the descriptions of those holy women of old, he's going to name one in verse 6, Sarah, call her by name. She's certainly one of them. What do we know about Sarah as far as her physical appearance? Yeah, she was. What about Rebecca? What about Rachel? Yeah, they were all pretty, but was Sarah's, I mean, the Lord made her pretty, but was that her, is that, other than that statement that we had that she was of fair countenance, is there anything else in Sarah's life that showed that that was anything to her and that that's what she was focused upon in her life? What do we read about Sarah? Everything we read about her, it's about her faith in God and all the good that she did in obeying the Lord. How much of that is connected to Abraham's faith in God and his obedience to the Lord? Well, really all of it. Because she was married to Abraham. So we know in Genesis chapter 12, Abraham was commanded by God to leave his home, his family, and to go to the land that God would show to him, which was Canaan, and he went. But he didn't go alone, did he? And it so happened, Abraham, the family Abraham was leaving behind was also whose family? Sarah was Abraham's half-sister, so I know that's a redneck joke when you, if somebody's married more than once and they have the same in-laws, but I mean, in this case, this was literally Abraham's half-sister, so obviously they had the same family, but when Abraham was leaving his family behind, wasn't Sarah leaving her family behind? And how many men have had a good situation when they were trying to force a move on their family that their wife wasn't on board with for whatever reason? Does that usually go well? No. But why did it go well with Abraham and Sarah when Abraham? I mean, how many women, if their husband told her, okay, God says we have to move and we have to leave our family, we're going somewhere far, far away, we're not going to be here anymore at all, we're not coming back, how many would say, okay, let's go? I mean, how many would respond like that? What did Sarah do? Abraham went, she went with him. Was she in subjection to her husband? She was, and so that's what we read about. Abraham went, and it tells how Sarah went with him in Genesis chapter 12. And of course, she's also mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11 by name, as she is here in 1 Peter chapter 3. But in Hebrews chapter 11, she's also called by name here. And what is this chapter about? What is Hebrews chapter 11 about? All of these great examples of faith, and what kind of faith? Not a faith only, but all of these, by faith they... Is there any one of a... If you start at the beginning of Hebrews 11, or really in verse 4 when he starts with Abel, And he goes all the way through to the end of the chapter. And, of course, it is quite a long chapter, down through 40 verses. All of these examples of faith that when we get to the beginning of chapter 12 that he says he surrounded us with, it's to help us to run our race in following Christ. And so among these, he's giving Sarah. But of all of these, which one does he say by faith? They just had faith. That's it. They didn't do anything, but they were saved by that faith only. By faith, they did something, every one of them. It was by their faith that they did some action of obedience to God's will. Everyone. And so that was the case with Abel that he mentions, with Enoch, with Noah. And then we get to verse 8, Abraham. And so he says in Hebrews 11, verse 8, by faith Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out not knowing whither he went. Well, who else could those exact same words apply to? Sarah. And she's going to be included here by name in a moment. So it wasn't just Abraham's faith. She had faith and did the same. Verse 9, by faith he sojourned in the land of promise as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Who else was there in tabernacles, sojourning in that land, looking for that city that whose builder and maker is God? Sarah. So that's why she's mentioned in the next verse, verse 11, through faith also Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore sprang there even of one, and him as good as dead, so many as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore, innumerable. These all died in faith. Does that include the one he just most recently named, Sarah? Yes, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confess that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country, and truly if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned, but now they desire a better country, that is a heavenly, wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. Does that include Sarah? Most surely it does. And not just her, but all those holy women that were there with those men. I mean, who was on the ark with Noah? And who was in the ark with his three sons? Their wives. Were they part of those holy women of old that he's speaking about there? I mean, and Rebecca and Rachel and Leah, these other godly women that we're told about, of course. But of course, Sarah, I mean, he calls her by name there. I mean, that great cloud of witnesses in Hebrews chapter 11 is not just the men there. And how many godly women are we told about in the Old Testament along with the godly men? I mean, how many godly women are we told about there? I mean, quite a few. And some of the ones that were included in that the Lord included into the lineage of his son, the physical lineage that he came through when he brought him into this world, did it include Rahab? Did it include Ruth? And for a reason. But we read about many of these godly women who trusted in the Lord, and he mentions that particular about Sarah there. She had judged him faithful who had promised. Did she trust the Lord? I mean, how could she have done all these same things that Abraham was doing by his faith if she didn't have the same faith and didn't trust the Lord like Abraham did? She's right there. So she's given as an example for Christian women to follow. And what was her adorning, outward or inward? obviously inward. And she trusted God to be in subjection to her own husband. So it says in verse 6, she obeyed Abraham and says, calling him Lord. What is that? Kurios is the Greek word for Lord. What is that a reference to when she called her husband Lord? That's an acknowledgement of authority. Lordship is authority. So, I mean, who was the Lord of her family? God gave Abraham that position. Did she resent that? Did she rebel against that? No. She acknowledged it and even referred to him in that manner, referring to him by according to the authority that the Lord had given to him. How committed was Sarah to obeying God's will for her as Abraham's wife and being in subjection to him? I mean, she's fully committed to that. And, I mean, she's acknowledging with the very word that she's speaking by which she addressed her husband. And any Christian woman that's doing the same spiritually is a daughter of whom, according to verse 6? Yes. Now, we are all, if we're children of God, who else's children are we spiritually? Abraham's, because who is the father of the faithful? He is. Abraham is. So it's impossible to please God without faith. We were just reading from Hebrews 11. Verse 6 says that. For without faith it is impossible to please God. We have to have faith. Abraham, we just read those verses and how much the Lord had to say about him as well as Isaac and Jacob and Sarah. But he's given as such an example of faith. The Lord tells us that we're all children of God by our faith, like Abraham had, and so therefore we are spiritually children of Abraham when we have faith in God. How much of Romans chapter 4 makes that point about Abraham's faith and our being his, and we're being his children when we have faith like he did? So we are all children of Abraham by faith. Christian women are also spiritually children of Sarah, Abraham's wife, when they follow Sarah's works and being in subjection to her husband. Can we claim to be children of Abraham if we're not doing the works of Abraham? Did anybody ever do that? Well, yeah. John chapter 8, when Jesus was, there was a crowd of people there. Jesus was teaching the Jews, and did some in the crowd believe him? Yes. In verse 31, well, verse 30, it says, as he spake these words, many believed on him. Many did. All of them? No, but many did. And then said Jesus to those Jews which believed on him. So the crowd contained some who now believe on him, but does it contain some who don't? So you got a mixture. But Jesus is addressing these particular words to which part of the crowd? The believers. And he said to those Jews which believed on him, if you continue in my word, then are you my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Verse 33 says, they answered him. Now, would this be the believers that are starting to argue? No, these would be the others in the crowd. And they said, we be Abraham's seed, and we're never in bondage to any man. How sayest thou, you shall be made free? Well, was he talking about political freedom? No, in which they claimed to never been in bondage to any man in that way. I mean, how many times had the children of Israel been in bondage to some foreign power in their history? And what about this very time? who was ruling over them at this very moment? The Romans. But Jesus said in reply, verse 34, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, whosoever committed sin is the servant of sin." He's talking about spiritual freedom, freedom from sin, which means not being, you still do it, but you just don't get charged with the guilt of it. No, what did he say? Who's the servant of sin? The one that's sadly to be blamed for doing it, or is it the one who does it? Whosoever commits sin is the servant, the slave of sin. Whosoever. Is there a such thing as committing sin and not being in bondage to sin? Whosoever commits sin is the servant of sin. Well, how do we ever get out of that? And what's the way out of it to not be committing the sin anymore? Well, is that possible? Who's got the power to give us that kind of freedom, set us free from sin where we can have steps to follow that will enable us to stop doing those things that made us slaves to sin, of sin in the first place? Christ. And so he says, if the servant abideth not in the house, the servant abideth not in the house forever, but the son abideth ever. If the son therefore shall make you free, ye shall be free indeed. Can we truly be free? He says so. I know that you are Abraham's seed, but you seek to kill me because my word hath no place in you. He's obviously not speaking to the ones who believed on him when he said that. But in verse 38, he says, I speak with that which I've seen with my father, and you do that which you have seen with your father. Jesus didn't have the same father that these ones who didn't believe in him had. They answered and said unto him, Abraham is our father. So were they claiming Abraham as their father? Yes. Jesus saith unto them, if you were Abraham's children, you would do the works of Abraham. So how is one demonstrated to truly be a spiritual child of Abraham? By doing the works of Abraham. Having his faith, obeying God like Abraham did. He says, but now you seek to kill me, a man that hath told you the truth, which I've heard of God. This did not Abraham. You do the deeds of your father. Which then in verse 44, he plainly said, their father was the devil. Well, there's the point. To be children of Abraham, you have to do the works of Abraham. Well, for a Christian woman to be daughters of Sarah, what do they have to do? The works of Sarah. Which work? Being in subjection to their husbands. That's what Sarah did. And so he says, whose daughters you are, as long as you do well. And that doing well, what is good, the particular good here, is what? It's in reference to her being in subjection to her husband. Well, of course, that wasn't the only way that Sarah did what was good in the sight of God. She obeyed all of his commandments, and so must Christian women. But this is the one that's in this context he's particularly referring to. I mean, no Christian woman that won't subject herself, be in subjection to her husband, is following Sarah's example. And so to be her spiritual daughters, they have to do that. But that's a great example to have, and also a great blessing. I mean, Christian men can't be spiritual daughters of Sarah in that way, but a Christian woman has the opportunity to be a child of Abraham, a son of Abraham, a daughter of Abraham and Sarah, by doing their works. And then he finishes up chapter verse 6 saying, as long as you do well and are not afraid with any amazement. Well, what's that in reference to? Well, what are those words there? That afraid, phobio, it's form of the Greek word phobos, which is fear. We get our word phobia from that. That's the common word for fear. Well, what in this context of 1 Peter 3, 1 through 6 might make her afraid? Anything going on here that could give her any reason to have fear? if somebody's got authority over you and then they're mistreating you with that authority, is there any temptation to be fearful? And then to use that as an excuse to what? Not do what the Lord commands there. He says, and not afraid with any amazement. That word amazement, there's the word literally means alarm. So fearful and alarmed. So one could be in a situation where they're being persecuted. I mean, one of the things that we're going to be tempted to do when we are being persecuted is to be filled with fear and alarm. Is that going to help us to obey the commandments of God and return good for evil and endure grief, suffering wrongfully? Or is that going to be something the devil can use to cause us to not obey the Lord's commandment? Well, we all know Revelation 21 and verse 8, when he describes the ones who are going to have their part in the lake of fire and brimstone that burns forever and ever. And how does he begin that? But the fearful and unbelieving. And then comes the rest of the list. It's interesting, he starts with the fearful. The man that was given one talent in Matthew 25, and he buried it in the ground. And what was his reason that he didn't use what the Lord gave him and produce for his Lord? He was what? He was fearful. That's not a good thing. So, could Sarah have said, "Well, I'm afraid to go. That's a land. I don't know the land. I don't know the people in that wherever we're going. It's a completely strange place, and I don't know what's going to happen to me there. And there's not going to be any family there." I mean, could she have gotten herself all worked up with fears and alarms and then not gone with her husband? And all the other situations that they went through when they went down to Egypt. The Pharaoh had his eye on her. I mean, think of how many circumstances that they went through where she could have gotten herself filled with fear and alarm and then not done what she was supposed to do as Abraham's wife. But she didn't. That didn't happen with her. And it shouldn't happen with Christians either. We can't let the devil get us filled with, because we can easily fill ourselves with all kinds of reasons why then we don't do what we should do in a situation that the Lord has commanded us to do something. So do we have to trust the Lord? We have to trust the Lord. That's where the emphasis has been repeatedly here. We have to trust the Lord with our lives. Brother Glenn? She did.
He set the right example for her and he taught her.
Yes. But even if, and what a blessing that she had Abraham, and what a blessing he had to have Sarah. We'll see in verse 7 that even if a Christian man doesn't have a Sarah, just as we've seen for a Christian woman who's a spiritual daughter of Sarah, I mean, he's really been talking about a situation where her husband is not as far from being an Abraham, but she's still got to do it, and she could get all fearful and alarmed and not. So that would have been a temptation for Sarah, as you point out, when she was with one who was Abraham. It could be a temptation for, and the devil's going to work on all of us in these situations in our lives, to get us filled with reasons why we shouldn't do what the Lord tells us to do in some situation. And fear is a big one that he uses to where he will get us to stop doing what we should do. But we can't give in to that. And Sarah didn't. And none of us should. In order to follow the steps of Christ, I mean, was Jesus afraid, or did he trust? If we're fearful, I mean, are we trusting the Lord? I mean, if we're afraid and we're just not going to do what we should do because some bad thing could happen, what are we saying to the Lord? Do we really believe he's going to work at all for our good? Do we really believe he's not going to ever leave us nor forsake us? Should we be like Job, who said, though he slay me, will I trust in him? And when Jesus was going to the cross and was going to die, what did he believe? His Father was going to raise him from the dead. What is ultimately our hope based in? That. So even if something happens in this life where it costs us our life, could we be persecuted to that point? It could happen. We still have to obey the Lord, but are we going to do that if we don't believe that the Lord's going to raise us up like he raised up his Son? I mean, are we going to follow in the steps of Christ if we don't trust the Father like he did? And that's for Christian men and Christian women. All right, Lord willing, we'll continue in verse 7. So the attention turns to the men in verse 7, husbands. But Lord willing, we'll look at that next Wednesday night together.